go. Our text this morning will be Hebrews 11, so if you have a copy of the scriptures, I'd invite you to join me there this morning. What are the things in your life that that cause your faith to be threatened? What are the things that threaten to sort of shake you at your core? Maybe it's fear or depression. Maybe there's specific venues or arenas of your life. Maybe it's vocation. Maybe it's a certain amount of discouragement over the course of time, or unemployment that has just begun to sort of make you question God's goodness and God's faith, or your faith in God. Maybe it's fear over some circumstance, over the future. I think if we thought very long about these types of things, we would certainly come to consider death on that list, right? The prospect of death is one that shakes us. Maybe a cancer diagnosis, right? Or the death of someone close to you, a parent or a child. These are certainly things that that shake us to our core. I was thinking about different people and their responses to death. My mind went to Gideon, and you might remember the account of Gideon. He was one of the judges in Israel's history. And during the time of Gideon, the Midianites kept oppressing the people of Israel. 120,000 plus, a horde of Midianites that would come in to the land and take all the crops every year. And Gideon, in this one episode, gathers together, he puts out word, hey, we're going to fight against the Midianites, and puts out the feelers, and 22,000 men show up. And they're standing there on the side of the mountain and looking down into the valley at this innumerable Midianite army. And what could 22,000 do against so many, right? And God says, of course, to Gideon, the unthinkable, you have too many soldiers. I want it to be clear when I give you this victory that all eyes are on me, right? And that they understand that this was the power of God. This was not human might, but this was the power of God. And you have too many soldiers. And so Gideon says, all right, if any of you are afraid, fearful to head into battle, you may go home. And 12,000 leave. I wondered where I would be in that split, right? How would I have responded if looking down over what was, humanly speaking, going to be a slaughter, and how I would have responded. And then you have other examples of people who faced death with tremendous confidence and tremendous hope. Most notably, our Lord, Jesus. I love this text. It's captured in John's Gospel. Jesus had just had the Last Supper with his disciples, and he goes off to pray, and he's going to be arrested and crucified within just a matter of hours. And this picks it up here in John 18. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. Very significant terminology. It was an enclosure. The garden was in an enclosure, and they went into the garden. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. They were up to no good, right? Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, there's the key, right? Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out. They came into the garden, and then Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said, and Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. I love this scene. Here is Jesus. He knows what's coming, right? And he's engaged in prayer and agonizing over the events that will unfold. And Judas has organized a clandestine secret ops, you know, mission, and he's going to surprise Jesus, right? He's got everybody there. They're coming under cover of nightfall. They're going to spring upon him in the garden, or not. Jesus says to the disciples, wake up, okay? And he leads them out of the garden, and they meet Judas as he's coming in. And Jesus says, who are you looking for? Looking for Jesus. And Jesus pronounces the great I am, a statement that was made about God used to describe himself. I am he. And they fall back onto the ground. And he asks them again in the next few verses, who are you looking for? Jesus. And he says, I am he. Let these others go. Let my disciples go. I mean, Jesus is clearly in control here, and he is walking out to his death. No one takes his life from him, but he offers it freely, he tells us in John's gospel. So a great scene. Who does that? Who knows that someone's coming to kill them and they go out to meet their killer? What kind of faith and confidence and hope is this, you know? And then if we go to early church history, there's Polycarp. Polycarp was the bishop of the church in Smyrna, and the first known martyr. Outside of the biblical accounts, Polycarp was the first. And he knew as well that they were coming to arrest him. The Romans were coming to arrest him. And they kept warning him, leave, go from here. They're coming. And he refused. And he greeted them at the door as they came. And went into interrogation. And Quadratus was the Roman official who was interrogating him and threatening him. And he says, you're going to be turned over to the wild beast. You're going to be burned at the stake if you don't renounce your faith. And Polycarp gives this classic line, but why do you delay? Come do what you will. Who does that? You know, who wishes their own death and faces it with such confidence? Well, the text we want to look at today, we're going to look at four individuals. They're given just a brief snippet about each of them. But I want to suggest to you that one of the common threads is how they evidenced their faith in the most dire circumstances in the face of death. And I think we learned some things here about how we can face death with that kind of confidence. So these individuals, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, the author could have cited any number of things in their life as evidences of faith, right? And yet, he chooses to focus on their faith in the face of death, the great enemy. And so we're going to look briefly at those four accounts and then draw several observations that I think help us to frame a very needed perspective in our lives. So first, Abraham. And let's look here at the Hebrews account, and then we'll consider each of them in turn. Hebrews 11:17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promise was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. He considered that God was able to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. May the Lord add his blessing to the reading of his word. So Abraham. Abraham, in his situation, was facing not his own death, But the death of his son, Isaac, that became the moment of great testing, right? How would Abraham respond in the face of something so unthinkable? It's one thing to lose someone close to us, a parent or a brother or sister, but to lose a child is one of the greatest burdens that anyone might be asked to bear. And here Abraham faces death, probably wishing that it was his own, as opposed to the death of his son. God had specified that the promise would come through Isaac. That Isaac would be the one. It wouldn't be any other child that would come from Abraham. It would be Isaac. And now he's being asked to offer Isaac as a sacrifice. So here's the test of faith. Let's look, take a glimpse here in Genesis 22. We won't read the whole account, but just these few verses to transport us again into Abraham's dilemma. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. We read here that it was a test. Right? God was discerning Abraham's heart, was providing an opportunity to learn where Abraham's ultimate loyalties lay. Would Abraham trust even when he was asked to give up what was most precious to him? How would Abraham respond? Does Abraham love me or Isaac more? And so these are all parts of what was going on here in this test. And Abraham obeyed. The text gives indication that he got up early in the morning. He seemed to show initiative. He didn't delay. He didn't drag his feet. He embraced God's command, which was unambiguous. It was clear. And he gathered two servants. They cut some firewood, saddled the animals, roused his young son, and they set off at break of day. No indication that he told Sarah about his plans. Wasn't something to be debated. It was simply something that he knew he was called to do. And as they made the 3-day journey, there was no overt conversation about what would take place on the mountain. When they reached the foot of the mountain, Abraham left his two servants behind, and he said to them, "My son and I are going to go up the mountain and worship, and we will return." Give you a glimpse into what Abraham's thinking, right? Abraham had full confidence that he would walk down that mountain with his son. And yet he was also fully committed to obeying the command of God. Hebrews gives us insight into Abraham's mindset. He reasoned, a word of great logic here. This isn't blind faith. He believed that God would always do what he said he would do. So he had the promise of God that God would bless him and extend his descendants through Isaac. And at the same time, he was being asked to sacrifice Isaac as a burnt offering. So he reasoned that God would raise Isaac back from the dead. And in essence, that's what happened. So we see the unfolding of Abraham's responses. So Abraham and Isaac continue up the mountain without the servants now, and they're nearing the top, and Isaac's gears are beginning to churn, and he says, "Daddy, we have the wood, and we have the fire, but where is the sacrifice?" And Abraham says, "My son, God will provide the sacrifice." And they continue up the mountain. And they lay the wood on top of the altar, catch their breath for a moment. And when the conversation can be put off no longer, Abraham says, "Isaac, God intends for you to be the sacrifice. I love you more than life itself, but I love God more. And we're committed to obeying God. I don't understand God's reasons, but I know that God is good. And I know that God is always right." And Isaac, in some sense, also evidenced faith here, didn't he? I think he could have run away from Abraham at this point, at this stage of the game. Abraham's an old man. Isaac isn't a toddler. But he climbs up onto the altar. And Abraham prepares the knife and raises it over his son, and God intervenes. God says, "Stop. I know. I now know where your heart lies. I know that you trust me." And Abraham looks over and sees in the thicket, in the brambles, a ram with its horns caught. And he takes that ram, and he and Isaac put that up onto the altar in Isaac's place. And Abraham comes up with a new name for God that day. He calls him Jehovah Jireh. "You are the God who provides." And there on Mount Moriah, God provided a sacrifice in Isaac's place so that Isaac's life could be spared. Moriah has another name. It's Jerusalem. Those are the mountains of Moriah, a series of mountains on which Jerusalem sits. And God would one day provide another sacrifice so that many others might be spared. He would send his own son, Jesus, to die in our place. For all who would respond in faith, for all who would receive that gift, can also say that God has provided. Through the gospel, throughout the scriptures, that reminder of the salvation that's been provided for us, it's captured so beautifully in the account of Abraham and Isaac. But you see Abraham here facing death and responding in faith. And then there's Isaac. Isaac was dying. He was blind. We're going to look at a portion of the text here. He was at the end of his life. And he pronounces a blessing on his sons, his twin sons, Jacob and Esau. And he pronounces a blessing on them. What's so significant about that, right? Well, let's consider the account here out of Genesis 27. Again, just a small portion of it. And then we'll think through why Isaac is commended for this act. Genesis 27, when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." He said, "Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me delicious food such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." So again, Isaac is facing death. We're not told a lot about Isaac's life. Two chapters in Genesis that are given over to Isaac. But what we are told is that his life was pretty difficult. He encountered famine during his lifetime. He was inclined, seemingly he was inclined to go down to Egypt to find food, as his father had done, as Abraham had done. But God said very specifically to Isaac, no, I want you to stay here in the land, and I will provide for you. I will help you to survive, but I want you to stay here in the land that I've promised to you. And Isaac did that, but it was a struggle. Abraham had dug certain wells, water so critical in that part of the world, right, where it's dry and water is not readily accessible. And it's not only about your own survival, but it's about the ability to keep flocks and herds alive. And so Abraham, his father, had dug certain wells in strategic places. But now at this point, the Philistines had come across the Mediterranean Sea and landed on the coast and began to make life very miserable for Isaac. A matter of fact, they, one after the other, began to go around and push earth into the wells that Abraham had dug. How discouraging do you think that would be? You go to the effort to dig a well, and then they come along and they fill it with sand. See, all these reminders that although Isaac was living in the land, they didn't possess the land. They were living there as foreigners. Didn't have walled cities that provided security. None of this. They were living from place to place in tents, trying to ward off invaders and people who might try to push sand in their wells. I mean, this is the story of Isaac. This is where things were at. And then to cap it off, Isaac had two sons. We would better say Isaac had only two sons. I mean, God had promised to make them, their descendants, Abraham's descendants, more than the stars in the sky and the grains of sand on the seashore. That's a lot. And they're two generations in, and they have two sons to carry on this legacy, this heritage. And one of those sons was a loser. He was ungodly and reckless. He didn't care a thing about God. He took two foreign wives who didn't worship God, and they became a thorn in the side for Isaac and Rebekah. Esau was just spiritually completely opposed to God and his purposes. So that's one son. And the other son, Jacob, preferred the kitchen to the battlefield. He was soft. He wasn't the type of one that was going to go out and lead and really establish and claim land and all of these things that were so important in that culture. So all of this is Isaac's setting. This is not exactly a robust success, right? None of these things have taken place yet. They have no land. They have very few descendants, two sons. And yet Isaac stands there over his two children, Esau and Jacob, and he pronounces a blessing, and he pronounces the hope of the promises of God. He conveys those things to his children in confidence that God will bring them to pass, even though it doesn't look like it. Now, we know if we look at the story more carefully that Isaac didn't exactly know how this was going to work itself out, did he? He's still thinking Esau. He's got his flaws, but at least he's a man's man. He's hairy. He likes to hunt. He's strong. He's got a bit of a temper, which is not all bad in a warrior culture, right? This is going to happen through Esau. He's the one that's going to bring some deliverance here. And of course, God had other plans, didn't he? God had already told Isaac's wife, Rebekah, that the blessing was going to come through Jacob, a fact that Isaac had trouble accepting. But ultimately, that's how it came about. But in any regard, Isaac in faith pronounces a blessing on Jacob and Esau. He lived in faith. As he came to the end of his life, he's blind, he's dying. This all seems to have been a grand failure. But by faith, he extends the blessing to his sons. Then there's Jacob. Jacob was ill, bedridden, and blind. Unable to stand, The text here draws attention to the fact that he mustered up his strength to sit up in bed and to lean upon his staff, to lean over his staff, and to pronounce a blessing on his grandchildren, the sons of Joseph. And again, we have this great last scene of Jacob's life. Here's a glimpse of it from Genesis 48. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, "Who are these?" And Joseph said to his father, "They are my sons, whom God has given me here." And he said, "Bring them to me, please, that I may bless them." Now the eyes of Israel, that's Jacob's nickname, okay? Jacob, Israel, same name. Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age so that he could not see. So Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, "I never expected to see your face. And behold, God has let me see your offspring also." That's beautiful, beautiful scene. Jacob thought that Joseph was dead, thought that he had been destroyed by wild beasts. And so he not only got to see Joseph alive, but he got to see Joseph's children. And he pronounces a blessing on them, and he really claims them as his own. You see the terminology there that he called them to himself and claimed them as his own. And Joseph brings them up to Jacob, his father, and he brings Manasseh up right in front of Jacob's right hand, and he brings Ephraim up right in front of Jacob's left hand. And of course, the right hand was the hand that we placed for the primary blessing, right, upon the firstborn child. And so it's all lined up there. Joseph knows that his father doesn't see very well, and so he's making sure all the arrangements are in place. And there is Jacob leaning over his staff, and he reaches out to extend the blessing. And he puts his right hand on Ephraim, the younger son. You say, what is going on there? Is Jacob confused? Joseph thought Jacob was confused. No, my father. This is the oldest. But you see, Jacob learned something from his own story, didn't he? God doesn't always use the strongest to accomplish his purposes. God didn't use Esau in all of his might and ruggedness. God used Jacob. And Jacob understood God's ways. And Jacob understood in faith that God would not bring about the victory. God would not fulfill the promises through human ingenuity and strength. God would bring about the promises in unlikely ways. And even the way in which Jacob pronounced that blessing evidenced his faith in the providence and sovereignty of God. That is Jacob. And then there's Joseph. Joseph, too, was at the point of death. He gathered his family and he talked to them about the Exodus. So, right, think about where we are in the story. Joseph had been sold into slavery by his brothers, taken into Egypt, falsely accused, imprisoned, but interprets Pharaoh's dream, preserves Egypt from famine, and is promoted to second in command in Egypt. And then his brothers and his father and his entire family are able to come to Egypt and be preserved from the famine. And so all this has taken place, and now we're coming to the end of Joseph's life. And Joseph is speaking to them that Egypt is not your home. They had a pretty good thing going in Egypt at this point. They were in favor with the Pharaoh. They had been given good lands. It was secure. It was the most powerful nation in the world at that time. So there was no threat of enemies. I mean, this was a good deal right here in Egypt. And Joseph comes to them in his dying days. and says, I want you to remember that God's going to take you out of here. And he gives them instructions regarding his bones. Here's a snippet from Genesis 50, if we go back to the account there. So Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's house. Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were counted as Joseph's own. So Joseph saw his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and saw their children's children. He began to see God fulfilling his promises, right? To make of them a great nation. Verse 24, and Joseph said to his brothers, to his countrymen, I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So his act of faith, as they sit securely in Egypt, was to remind the people that this was not home. And I think he could have been dissuaded by a lot of things. He could have been dissuaded by bitterness. The bulk of his life, he's 110, the bulk of his life had been lived in Egypt. He had maybe 17 years that he lived in Canaan, and it was not pleasant memories. He had been treated so poorly by his brothers, betrayed, sold into slavery, presumed dead. Why would you want to go back there, right? This is where he made his fortune. This is where he was somebody. Why go back to that sorry chapter of my life? But Joseph continued to cultivate a sense of who he was and who they were as the descendants of Abraham. He could have been deterred by time. God had made the promise to Abraham, and then had reiterated the promise to Isaac, and had reiterated the promise again to his father, Jacob. And now we are in the fourth generation. Hundreds of years have gone by, and God still had not fulfilled that promise. They still were a relatively small group of people, not a great nation, and they had no land. It could have been a point where Joseph said, I'm bailing on that program. That is clearly not coming to fruition. We've given it time, and it's not happening. But he wasn't dissuaded by time. Could have been dissuaded by silence. God gave the promise to Abraham. God intervened and reiterated the promise to Isaac. And he reiterated the promise again to Jacob. But we have no indication that God overtly reiterated the promise to Joseph. Even in the text here we just looked at, God will visit you, this last verse, verse 24, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. He had not overtly swore this land to Joseph, but Joseph was claiming the promises that had been handed down to him, and he continued to trust that God would fulfill his word. Certainly, he could have been distracted by prosperity, all the things that he enjoyed in Egypt. But he wants to pass on this identity to his countrymen, and this faith, and he gives very interesting instructions regarding his bones, right? Jacob, his father, had said, I don't want to be buried here in Egypt. When I die, I want you to bury me in the land of Canaan, in the promised land, with Abraham and Isaac. But Joseph has a little twist, doesn't he? When he prepares to die, he says, I don't want you to take my bones to Canaan right now, but God is going to show up and he's going to lead you out of here. And when you go, and you will go, I want you to take my coffin with you. And they did. 400 years would pass before God would deliver the Israelites, the Hebrew slaves, out of Egypt. But when they left, They took Joseph's coffin and they carried it as they crossed the Red Sea, and they carried it for 40 years in the wilderness, and they carried it when they crossed the Jordan River until they arrived in the land that God had promised them. And Joseph wanted them to have his words echoing in their minds. See, these patriarchs understood that death was not the end. It was something to be grieved. It's a sobering reality of sin. But it is not something to be feared. It is not the end. Even Abraham, think about that. He's asked to sacrifice his son Isaac, and he reasons that God will raise Isaac from the dead. I mean, he didn't even have categories in which to think about that. But he understood that death was nothing to God, to the God who created life, to the God who had created Isaac from two parents who couldn't have children and were beyond the age of childbearing. God had already brought life out of death. Death was nothing for God. And these patriarchs understood that. You remember Jesus' words to Martha and Mary and others who were there mourning the death of Lazarus? Tells them in John 11, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he dies, yet will he live. And he who believes in me will never die. In other words, death is not the end for the followers of God. They understood that God had a plan that transcended death. God wasn't just carrying out all of his purposes in one person's lifetime, but God had an overarching, comprehensive plan of which we are permitted to play a part, of which they were permitted to play a part. But they understood that God's plan was bigger than any one person or any one lifetime. Perspective of the patriarchs. I want to have it. I want to be able to stare death in the face. There's a great section in Pilgrim's Progress. Christian, of course, has this great burden that he bears, the burden of sin, and he's able to rid himself of that burden at the cross. And then he continues on his journey towards the celestial city, towards the city of God, towards God's country, God's kingdom. And he's moving along, and he comes within sight of the celestial city. And then he is taken back because between him and the celestial city is a great river. And he questions whether there's another way to get to the celestial city other than through the river. And he's told that there is not, that one must pass through the river. And he asks how deep the river is. And he receives by the way, the river represents death, right? And he asks how deep the river is. How fearsome is death? And he is given this counsel that he would find it deeper or shallower as you believe in the king of the place. In other words, a person who doesn't know God, a person who doesn't know the king, will find the river to be extremely deep. But the person who finds and has a confident relationship with the king, with God, will find the river to be relatively shallow. And I think that's what's going on with the patriarchs. Their experience of death and the difficulties of dying, right? Blindness and infirmity and all the things they experience, just like we do. They did not in some way be given a special pill that would sort of make them immune from fear. But their perspective was that God was bigger than death. And they had such a strong relationship and a strong confidence in God and in his promises that death was a relatively minor thing. So let me ask these questions. Our time is nearly gone this morning. What difference would it make if you were to take God at his word without reservation? Abraham. I mean, all of them. God promised it, and there was no question. Even though hundreds of years went by, Joseph believed the promise just as much as Abraham did when it was first given. I mean, they just took God at his word. What God says is true, and it will come to pass. Abraham, God promised to bless him through Isaac, and then God commanded him to sacrifice Isaac, and so he knows that this is all going to work out, and he's just trying to put the pieces together in his mind as best he can, but he's completely confident in the promise of God. It will come to pass. This is how it is. This is true. And I'm just not sure sometimes that we always have that same confidence when we read God's word, when we read the scriptures, right? When God says, this is what I want you to do, and this is how I want you to live, we have in the back of our mind that I'm not sure that's going to work out so well. You know, like Eve in the garden, right? God had given these parameters and these instructions and all of these things for her good, and yet she began to question the trustworthiness of God. Certainly, one of the things we learned from these patriarchs that would help us to face death is to just hold unflinchingly to the truthfulness and trustworthiness of God's promises. How would it change your perspective if you recognized the difficult trial you were experiencing was a test? Now, this is, again, referenced specifically to Abraham and Isaac, where we're given a little bit of insight that God wasn't just trying to create a really hard situation. He wasn't wanting to make Abraham miserable. He wasn't wanting to just tear out Abraham's heart. He had a different purpose in mind. He was wanting to test Abraham. He wanted to prepare him for what was to come. And you look over and over again with the patriarchs, and you see how long it took them to have children. I mean, God prevented them, not because he didn't like them, because God was at work strengthening their faith. I mean, David's on the run from King Saul for years. Things aren't materializing in terms of him being given the kingdom. You know, he's struggling. And before that, he's watching sheep while his brothers are off doing important stuff in the war. But see, all of these things God was using to test David and to prove his character and to prepare him for what he was going to do. Review some of those great tests and difficulties and struggles in our lives. We view them as tests. This is an opportunity. It's easy to say I love God in the midst of prosperity and blessing, but God's giving me an opportunity in this hard job situation to show that I love him, even when it's not easy. Even when he takes something away from me that I love, I get a chance to show my loyalty to him. What intentional efforts are you making to convey a godly legacy to your children or grandchildren? Three of these, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, all had to do with them in their later years conveying the hope of the promises to their kids and to their grandkids. What a monumental task that I think sometimes we underestimate. And particularly for those who have grandkids. Maybe you think you're retired or, you know, my important years are behind me. Baloney. I mean, look at the impact that these older gentlemen had in conveying a legacy of faith to their children and to their grandchildren. I mean, this earns God's great commendation. There's so much work to be done, even in our later years. How would it change your attitude if you stopped expecting God to accomplish all of his purposes in your lifetime? We expect God to act now. We're so short when it comes to patience. And we tend to approach death and things didn't pan out as we had hoped, or the things that we had thought would be accomplished in our lifetime were not accomplished, and all of these different things. I don't think these patriarchs clearly didn't expect that everything would be fulfilled in their lifetime. And that allowed them to live with faith in the bigger purposes of God. Patriarchs live by faith to the point of death. What is the limit of your faith? Talk about holding our faith when we come to the point of death. The reality is some of us are inclined and prone to bail on our faith far before that. Right? And whatever the other hardships and circumstances and difficulties that come along, our faith is sometimes shaken. Be challenged to think about what it would be like to live by faith to the end, even to the point of death. My brothers and sisters, unless Jesus returns first, we will all face death. But we believe that God is more powerful than death, that God's plan transcends death, and that the dead will be raised. I urge you to live in hope through every difficulty and even in the face of death, for God's promises are true. Amen. Go in peace.